It's time to change the situation if Tottenham wants to change.
It's in the past, it's in the past. Then we look forward, buy our football positive. We're wearing Tottenham shirts, we play the Tottenham way.
And still Ricky Villa! What a fantastic run! He scored!
That's going to have a crack. He is, you know.
Well, hello, everybody. Merry Christmas and soon to be very happy New Year. This is Marcus Buckland with the final Tottenham Way podcast of 2024. And, an interesting year to say the least. Over the course of the next 40, 45 minutes, we will name our player of the year, our highlight of the year, our low point of the year. Unfortunately, there are a few of those to choose from of late. And we'll reflect on what's happened over the Christmas period, which hasn't been great, and what is going to happen at the start of 2025. What a busy period with Newcastle at home, the first leg of the League Cup semi-final against Liverpool, and then the potentially daunting trip to Tamworth in the third round of the FA Cup. Dan Kilpatrick of the Evening Standard and Tom Allnutt of the Times are with me. Merry Christmas, guys. I know it's difficult to be too merry at the moment. Dan, let me start with you because you're at Tottenham on Sunday. Gets very confusing on what day of the week it is, but for the Wolves game, my feeling there was that more than anything else, I just could not believe how apathetic everybody was. There was just no real sense of excitement, almost an acceptance that Spurs weren't going to win the game, and walking down a very dark Tottenham High Road afterwards, I could not recall a more dispiriting experience, really. And yet Spurs, I thought, in patches played well against Wolves. So what was your assessment of that game? Also, the Forest defeats. I've heard mixed reactions to that because Spurs had a lot of the ball but didn't really seem to create too many opportunities. So just give us your assessment, first of all, of the two matches that have accrued just 1 point thus far over this Christmas period.
Hi, Marcus. Happy New Year and belated Merry Christmas. I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that that's as dispiriting an experience as you've had at Tottenham, because I'm obviously not going there as a supporter, I'm going there as a reporter, but I didn't feel that it was as bleak as it has been, say, in the death throes of Mourinho's tenure or Conte's tenure, or even kind of late stage Pochettino, where it felt really apathetic. I didn't get that impression, but obviously you are in the terraces, so I'm interested to hear that, I have to
well,
say.
Well, let me just, I'll just try and clarify that point by saying you're absolutely right. There have been worse periods when there's been, you know, visible anger and obvious, I want to say disgust, but certainly, yeah, no, real anger at the way the club is going. And there is still that, of course. But yesterday, the thing that struck me more than anything else was just the apathetic nature of the fans expecting Spurs not to win, and when Wolves equalised late on, not being that upset. It's almost as though people have switched off. We're in this perpetual cycle. Nobody knows what the answer is. There isn't really an answer. And so it was just copy and paste. That's the point I'm trying to get across, I think.
Yeah, and I get that. I spoke to someone who went to the Liverpool game and said it was quite a strange atmosphere when they scored the fifth to make it, I think, 5-1, and that it felt like there wasn't the anger that you'd expect from supporters watching their team go 5-1 down. So I get where you're coming from with that. I mean, look, to sort of take the two games as a whole, because we didn't manage to do a reaction pod after Forest, I did kind of feel, I think I said it on this pod around about the Rangers game, after the Rangers game, that I found it hard to see results and performances getting significantly better unless there was a break in the schedule, or B, a lot of players came back from injury. And obviously neither of those things were ever going to happen until January. The Southampton game being just such an easy game against such a bad team, almost kind of anomalous game in the Premier League, acted as a sort of circuit breaker and kind of allowed Spurs to then go on and beat Man U with a pretty strong first hour of the game. But then since then, particularly because the second half against Man U was so catastrophic and it kind of became a difficult game when it shouldn't have been, it's been back to the kind of trudge for Spurs, and things haven't really got better. I think Spurs played okay. They were lacking an edge in the final third. Watching that game, I felt like as soon as Forest scored, that was that, really. I couldn't see Spurs getting a goal back, partly because Forest is such a well-organised defensive team, but partly because Spurs looked like a team lacking energy. And then yesterday, I thought Spurs played pretty well again for the most part. Actually had more energy than Wolves in the first half and kind of deserved to go in a half-time ahead. And then understandably couldn't maintain those levels and faded a bit in the second half. But I didn't feel like the equaliser was kind of coming a mile off. It wasn't one of those games where you just felt like, oh, they're going to concede here. It was actually a clever piece of play from Wolves. And Spurs were a bit asleep. There wasn't enough pressure on the ball that Ike Nori played, I think, to Strand Larsen. But still, I didn't feel like Wolves were kind of hammering on the door. It was a draw that felt a bit like a defeat. I think that's fair to say. It doesn't really change much in terms of the mood or the narrative at the moment. And another kind of really frustrating result that continues this bad run. So really, results haven't improved. And there hasn't been a break in the schedule and players haven't come back. That's now changing. There is a break. There's a week to Newcastle. And after that, it's Liverpool. And then there's Tamworth in the Cup, which you'd imagine, given they're a non-league side in the fifth tier, I think, would be a game where Spurs can play at a much lower intensity and make a lot of changes. So there are a couple of circuit breaks coming. And I think this is a crucial period for Postecoglou, clearly, because the Cups are important. They're kind of what the season's hinging on at the moment. And the excuse of fatigue will no longer be there, I think, because he'll have a rejuvenated squad going into Newcastle. They still only have 13 or 14 players, because Udogie's probably not going to be fit and Bentancur's suspended. But they'll be fresh players, and Spurs should be able to play at a high intensity. So I've actually written a piece today for The Standard saying the statistics and the football and the results and all the rest of it make for pretty grim reading for Postecoglou. But let's see where Spurs are after this circuit break. Let's see where they are at the end of this coming week. And kind of will be in a better position then, I think, to make a judgment call on whether these flaws are just really baked in or whether this is just a result of a completely exhausted group of core players who have just played far, far too much football and can't play the manager's football given the schedule.
And that's the key point, I think, Dan. You know, can anybody at this level play the style of football that Ange Postecoglou demands? Is it viable? Tom, I'm going to come to you. I'm just going to give you a few interesting stats. I got home last night and I thought, I'll just look now, because Postecoglou's had exactly a season and a half, 57 league games. And in that time, he has picked up 90 points. And of course, a large chunk of those came very early on. You know, that wonderful first 10 or 11 games of last season. So 90 points from 57. In comparison, obviously, Nuno can't be counted because he only took charge of 10 matches, during which he picked up 15 points. But after 90 from Postecoglou, you have Mourinho, 94 from 57. Then Pochettino, 99 points from his first 57 games in charge. And out in front, although Conte didn't last any longer than 57, he picked up 106 points in that time. And yet there was no surprise whatsoever when Conte left the club. And I appreciate there was all sorts going on behind the scenes. And Dan lit the fuse with the press conference at Southampton. I mean, these eras are all different. But those are the points tally. And there's Conte with 16 points more out of the door. Where is Postecoglou at this stage in his tenure, do you think?
I sort of think they're interesting stats, Marcus, but I also think that each of them is so kind of laced with context and circumstances. The direct comparison, I feel like if you kind of dig down a couple of layers, is slightly unfair. Only because we know that Conte's first year or so in charge of Spurs, you know, that first season when he took over, was incredibly successful. They sort of enjoyed this incredible boost, you know, and they had a team that was basically ready made, you know. But we also know that the last kind of 2 or 3 months, it was clear to everybody that the team was going nowhere, you know. So whereas with Ange, you know, we know that they had a very good start, but the second half of last season was underwhelming. They had a goodish start to this season, and then they've nosedived since, you know, October, November or whatever. So and equally, it, you know, this team that Ange is building is a new team. You know, it's a new group of players. I mean, all of those managers you said before, it's a very simple thing to say, they all had Harry Kane. You know, they all had Harry Kane in the team scoring 25 goals through every season. Spurs don't have that. This new team doesn't have that. And I think Ange, if he was here, would be saying, you know, I took over a team that finished eighth, took over a team that sold Kane the day before the start of the season, that was tasked with not only transforming the kind of style of play, but also a whole new team, bringing in younger players. So I personally think that Mourinho and Conte were essentially given a team to kind of push over the line, but a team that basically had quite a high floor. Postecoglou was basically given a whole new team, which has a lower floor and probably a slightly lower ceiling as well right now. You know, so I take your point, you know, and I think we'll get into, you know, this year and where it is. But I don't look at that and think, you know, I wish Spurs still had Conte, or I wish they still had Mourinho. You know, I think you have to accept that the circumstances are very different in this Postecoglou era. I think just to add to what Dan was saying about this last couple of weeks, I mean, you look at those three games that we've had really over the kind of Christmas period, Liverpool, Forest and Wolves. And I think in a way they're quite sort of symptomatic of where Spurs are right now. Three very different games, you know, one against basically the bar setters in the league where they were way off it. We knew that. They had a game away to a really difficult team in the league right now, who are very organised, very difficult to break down. One of the kind of outliers almost in terms of their style. Very good defensively, almost like an old school Burnley. You know, what Dan's right. Once you go 1-0 down to Nottingham Forest away right now, that's a very difficult game to get back into. And Spurs are not a good enough team right now to win that game. They're not efficient enough. They're not solid enough. They're not the kind of side, you know, that we saw maybe in the kind of peak Pochettino years that would go to these difficult places and win 1-0 or 2-0. I wasn't surprised they didn't win that game either. And then I guess the third sort of different type of match, home to a sort of struggling side, kind of game you expect them to win. And that one, they also came up a little bit short, you know. And I think Postecoglou is entering a red zone. You know, that's where I'm at. You know, I take Dan's points and I think it's fair to say that he's got a lot of players to come back. And the next few weeks will be very instructive, I think. But this has been a really difficult period. You know, we sat here, I think, probably two or three weeks ago and said these similar things, you know, that the in the next few weeks it's going to be important. That was after the Chelsea game. And since then, nothing has really improved, you know. So they're 11th, you know, they're 11th in the table. And that's not good enough with this squad. Even with all the asterisks about injuries, etc., they're 11th. And that's just not good enough, I don't think, for this team.
No, that is the bottom line. A couple of other points I'd like to make on that front, and I've said this before, but I do think that one of the main jobs of a coach or a manager is to improve your players. And with the exception of Dejan Kulusevski, perhaps Brennan Johnson as well, I don't think Ange has improved anybody. So that's a bit of a damnation against him. Having said all that, and this is the other point, Dan.
Well, you don't think Ange has improved Pape Sarr or Udogi or Pedro Porro or Van de Ven or any of those players? I mean, I think... Or Vicario. I mean, he clearly has.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm honestly not sure. I certainly don't think they're any better now than they were at the start of last season when they were fantastic. And that's when they just arrived at the club. So they had a lot of natural ability anyway. I think that's questionable. The bottom line, though, Dan, there is so much angst amongst Spurs fans. I think obviously much more on social media than if you go to the ground. It was interesting yesterday. I didn't hear any chance of Ange out. Didn't hear much of that Levy song yesterday either, which all relates to the sense of apathy, which is perhaps partly a reflection of the time of the year. I mean, we're in that sort of dark period between Christmas and the new year where nobody knows what they're doing and what time it is and what day it is, etc., etc. But of course, there's a big posse of supporters online who want Ange out. There are still plenty who want him to stay. I must say that deep down, and it's no surprise, I kind of feel that it's not going to work with Postecoglou, but I've also come round to the fact that there is absolutely no point in sacking him right now unless Spurs have got a brilliant succession plan, which I doubt is the case. I mean, the name's being touted. If he was to go, the likes of Andoni Iriola, who's done a fantastic job at Bournemouth, Marco Silva at Fulham, these are all managers who are in work and surely don't want to leave at the moment. So if there is no great succession plan, having Ryan Mason again, with all due respect, as a temporary manager for a few months seems pointless. So my feeling is you're right, this is a bit of a circuit breaker. Let's get some of the players back. Let us see if with the bulk of his first team, Postecoglou can galvanise the side and produce a bit of glory, as he reminds us he always does in his second season. I think that's always been your theory. Has that changed? My only caveat to that would be if we lost to Tamworth in the Cup, the big if, but if we did, or if we do get sucked into a relegation battle, which I know sounds outlandish, but we're nearer to the relegation zone, I believe, than we are to the top four. I think we're like 11 points off that and only 10 points from the bottom three. So if we lose to Tamworth or really get sucked down, then maybe they'll have to do something dramatic. But have your thoughts changed in any way regarding the at least the short-term future of the manager?
No, I mean, I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I mean, I agree with Tom that Postecoglou is entering the red zone at a critical period, and it does feel like the season is increasingly dependent on the Cups. I mean, Postecoglou made a point in his press conference after the Wolves game of saying he still thinks the league season is alive because it's very congested in there, and he's still confident that when he gets players back, Spurs can go on a run and kind of surge up the table. I'm less convinced at that, because partly because I just don't see players coming back in sufficient numbers. It feels like there's always going to be players missing. And obviously, we're now entering a period where it looks like Richarlison and Mikey Moore might be fit enough for the bench next week at some point. Ben Davis and Van de Ven should be back fairly soon. But Udogie's looking like he's got a bad hamstring injury, so he's going to be out. And there's more suspensions coming up, with Bentancur missing Newcastle and Saar and Maddison missing Liverpool. So the strain on the squad isn't going away. But I do believe that Spurs are capable of beating anyone in a one-off game. As Postecoglou's said, it feels like a lot of stars have to align for that to happen, particularly against Liverpool. But I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility, particularly if Liverpool rest players for the Carabao Cup, which I suspect they will. And then I look at the Europa League as well and think Spurs still seem like the strongest, or one of the strongest sides in that. My theory is always that English clubs that take it seriously always do well. They just do. They're just inherently stronger than other teams in the competition. So Spurs should have a good chance of that if they avoid a really unwanted two-legged playoff. So I do think that the season is kind of still alive in kind of many respects for Postecoglou, but there are a lot of huge banana skins coming up. I mean, Tamworth being one. I'm not too concerned about that myself, but you never know. But Liverpool feels like a big one. You can't get stuffed at home in the first leg, because then you go to Anfield with very little hope at the start of February. There's obviously a North London derby coming up and another home game against a really informed Newcastle. And the home record at the moment is dismal. I think it's now 5 games without a win in a row at home. I think if Spurs had lost to Wolves, they would have set a record for consecutive home defeats that would stretch back to 1955. I mean, obviously, they weren't in a great deal of danger of losing that game, I didn't think. But, you know, that tells you how poor the form has been. So, yeah, certainly Postecoglou's in a bit of trouble. I revert to what I said at the top. You know, I would like to sort of judge him when the players have had a rest and he's got a few back. I mean, we can argue about whether that team should have had enough to beat Wolves, given that Cunha went off at half time and Wolves had a 34-year-old Craig Dawson at centre half. My daughter's just walked in the room, so hopefully she won't say anything. Oh, I'm gonna pass this point over to someone else for the time being.
Is she? It sounds to me like she's calling for Postecoglou's head. Oh, there we are. A big anti-Ange fan has joined the podcast. Tom, another stat, Dan's just thrown one in. Spurs have now conceded the first goal at home 15 times in 2024, which is a Premier League record. Where do you stand on whether he's improved some of the players? Also, what intrigues me is the seeming, I don't know, undertone of, is dissension the right word? What's happening with Maddison? He keeps being left on the bench. I go back to why Jed Spence had to wait so long before he was given a chance as well. Felt yesterday, I appreciate that, you know, you've got an 18-year-old in Archie Gray playing in central defence. Dragosin, it was important that he started. But Postecoglou made the point that if Dragosin hadn't been available, who would he have turned to? Well, there is another 18-year-old, or is he 19, Alfie Dorrington. of course, the last thing you want is two teenagers in the centre of your defence. But the fact that he kind of dismissed Dorrington as even being a possible option in the centre of defence just makes me wonder what the atmosphere is like behind the scenes. And you guys get to see Ange every week. Dan's chided me before, but I always feel there's quite a passive-aggressive nature to his approach to the media. I don't know what it's like with the players, but what's your sense of how things are behind the scenes, and why is Maddison not playing more?
Well, I think if you're thinking about where the players are with regards to Ange, I don't think we're yet seeing signs that the team has lost faith in his methods. I'm not seeing a team that is, you know, lost all discipline, that is flying around the pitch, not listening to the manager anymore. I still see a Postecoglou team out. Now, whether or not you believe that is a style of play that can succeed long term is a different debate. But I do see a team that is playing loyal to what Ange wants them to do. I don't think that he has lost the dressing room yet, you know. And it, with regards to Maddison particularly, I mean, in a way, Maddison is a sign that Postecoglou is trying to adapt. You know, that he is at least trying to change the team to make it slightly more solid. I personally think that Maddison has played well this season. When he's played, I think he's actually done a decent job, and I feel a bit sorry for him, because I see a player who is desperately trying to prove himself and that he can fulfil the role that Ange wants him to play in central midfield, and yet he's being very kind of stop-starty, not really being used consistently. And when we see Spurs struggling to break down the likes of Nottingham Forest or even Wolves, you know, I often think the team is crying out for Maddison. I mean, if you're looking at players that Ange has improved, it's difficult to say because it's such a new team. You know, that so many of these players are new signings that came in under Ange. He hasn't exactly sort of taken players who were struggling under Conte and Mourinho and sort of suddenly unleashed them. You know, I mean, Kulusevski is obviously a shining example. You know, I think we're seeing the best Kulusevski we've ever seen at Spurs. And you can't deny that's come under Ange's leadership. It's come after Ange has changed his role and his position. You know, so we have to give him credit for that one. Equally, you know, and perhaps this cancels that out, I think Son is really struggling this season. You know, we're seeing a player, for example, against Forest, who I thought was pretty anonymous, you know, and the problem Tottenham have there is they haven't got the rotations for these players. When they go through these dips, they haven't got the right, you know, the backups to bring on. You know, they're bringing on Timo Werner for Son in the second half against Forest. Is that really going to do much? You know, it's not, is it? I mean, and that is consistent all over the pitch. Is that down to Ange? Not particularly, you know. I mean, they left him short in central defence because they basically got Ben Davies as a fourth centre half when really Ben Davies should be a fifth centre half. Dragić in his third centre back when maybe he should be fourth. They've got Forster playing number two goalkeeper when he should probably be number three goalkeeper. All across the squad, they're light, you know, and that is, you know, has been exposed because Ange's style of play creates a lot of, you know, injuries, which we know, and they've been exposed, you know. And I think, you know, if we come on to where the squad is and what they want from the January transfer window, Ange's team, perhaps more than any other team in the league, needs depth. It needs depth. It needs rotations. It needs players you can come in. And unfortunately, you know, the Tottenham just haven't got that.
No.
They really haven't got
that. Dan, go on. Because you've always had a bit of a soft spot for Ange, which is absolutely fine. But do you think the players are still right behind him?
Yeah, I do have a soft spot for Ange, I've got to say. You know, I think what I like about how he's dealing with the current crisis, if we can call it a crisis, is that, and I've made this point many times before, it's the absolute polar opposite of the way his predecessors would have dealt with it. And I think he deserves credit for that. You know, whether or not you set any store by rhetoric, whether you think words are important or just actions are important, is, you know, up to you. But I think had we seen this present injury crisis under Mourinho or Conte, for example, they would have just come out and said, we had absolutely no chance in that game. You know, this defeat is to be fully expected. I had no defenders. What can I do? And that's not what Ange is saying. He's saying I'm taking responsibility. He's still trying to win games, and I think he's dealing with the situation with a lot of kind of humanity and, in many cases, humility as well. I know he's often been accused of not having enough humility, but I think there have been, you know, a lot of shows of that so far. So yeah, I do have a soft spot for him. I do think the players are still behind him. I agree with Tom. I think we're still seeing them try to execute Ange ball, although it's tough in their present condition. And it does feel kind of like, although you've talked about the apathy, and I think I've detected that as well, and the vibes obviously aren't good, it doesn't kind of feel like the vibes within the club, you know, when you're speaking to people at the club, are really bad. And I've obviously experienced kind of bad vibes at Spurs over the years of covering them. It doesn't feel like we've reached that point where and just kind of lost staff members of the club, and everyone is kind of preparing for a change. Yet that isn't the impression I get, and I don't think that's just wishful thinking. I mean, just to finish the point I was making before my toddler burst into the room there, perhaps Spurs should be beating Wolves, whatever team they put out. But it is worth saying, as Tom's just said, that they had Fraser Forster in goal at the end, Porro, who looks tired, Dragusin, who's still only 22 and hasn't done a year in the Premier League yet, 18-year-old Archie Gray, who many people think is going to be a midfielder, and Reguilon, who has not played for the club in the league since April 2022, before that game. So, you know, that is not a defence that you would necessarily expect to hold out against kind of anyone in the Premier League, with the possible exception of Southampton, for a long, long time. It's just substandard. And I think a big question is how much responsibility is on Ange for these injuries. And you know, that is clearly an issue, because players keep coming back and breaking down, and Ben Davis is the latest, and the Van der Ven and Romero incidents probably on Ange. But, you know, I think if we put that to one side for a minute and just look at what he's working with at the moment, it is very, very far from ideal, which is why I kind of keep coming back to, I'm interested to see kind of over the next week, when there are a lot of big games and a lot of banana skins, kind of how Spurs play and how they perform and what results they get.
Yeah, but Dan, that's the crux of the matter. Sorry, Tom, I know you're going to come back in. That is the crux of the matter. If these injuries are going to be a constant under Postecoglou because of the demands he places on his defenders in particular, then there is no hope, because unless they sign sort of 8 quality players for each position, Tom, they're always going to be short, and it's just going to be
8 markers, not 8, but 2 or 3, you know, and that is kind of modern football at the end of the day. Like at the moment, Spurs are dealing with 13, 14 players they really trust and rely on, and that is the problem. I don't think it's impossible. Like I you're sort of saying it there as though, you know, the style of play is basically unsustainable. I actually think it's not unsustainable. You have to have a squad. You know, you look at the Liverpool squad right now, you look at their forward options they have. They have about 5 or 6 players. They've been without Jota now for 2 or 3 months. If Spurs are without Jota, or let's say Solanke, they're in real, real trouble. Whereas Liverpool can absorb that because they got Gakpo, they got Diaz, they got Salah, they got a forward line that at least they have 6 or 7 really good options for 3 spots. Spurs have 3 spots up there, and what they have maybe 4 good options, and, you know, that maybe has been generous, you know. So this is the problem. The squad is not deep enough to play Ange's style of play. You can either say that Ange should adapt, therefore, and create a style of football that is less draining on the legs, or you can say the club should have supported him and made a bigger squad. Maybe that has to happen in time. But I think in terms of the season, it's never a good place to be clinging to the cups. You know, I think we've been in this position before in the last 2 or 3 seasons where you sort of think, well, the team are not performing, the league looks like it's gone. But just imagine if they just happen to kind of beat X in the League Cup semi-final, or they happen to win the Europa League and then they qualify for the Champions League. Football doesn't tend to happen like that. It doesn't tend to be that you can sort of perform badly for 70% of the time and then suddenly deliver for 20% of the time when it matters. I don't think that's a great place to be for this team. It is true that they are still in the Europa League. They're still in the League Cup. They have a chance in both of those competitions. But I think ultimately the real disappointment here is you look at the position in the league. If they double their points tally, at this point, halfway in the season, they're going to be on 48 points, you know, which is what, you know, enough for, I don't even know what it's enough for, 12th, 13th, you know. They need 65 points probably to get into that kind of conversation for fifth. So it's going to have to be a huge upswing in their form in the second half of the season to get in that conversation for the Champions League places. But ultimately, what are we saying here? You know, what is the alternative? Even if they go on a bad run, even if they slip out of the cups, unless the team really unravels, he loses the players, and as you say, those kind of nuclear options like relegation battles, etc. What are we saying? We'd rather Spurs finish the season with Mason and interim again, that we think that they'd be better off with, you know, someone else in charge who we don't really think is the right appointment as a manager. I think personally not. And I think there is a middle way here, I think, which maybe hasn't really been discussed, which is that actually Ange does 2 years, and the Spurs think he's done a good job, you know, for what he needed to do. They reformed the squad. They built a team in his image. They created a sort of a young nucleus. They changed the style of play. But ultimately, they think, okay, after 2 years of a 3-year contract, was it 3 or 4-year contract? They think that they need to go in a different direction, you know, and they can push on with someone else. And that's not a disaster, by the way. That can happen in football. It can happen in any walk of life, like any business. They can decide that actually Andrew was good for 2 years. And at the end, they both shake hands and walk away and Spurs go and look for Iraola or Silva or whatever it is, you know. That is a possibility, but do it sensibly. You know, do a sensible process here where they get to the end of the season and move it through in a proper way. I personally don't think, unless something really unexpected happens in the next few weeks, that moving to an interim situation, middle of the season, is really the way to go.
I think that's a really good point and is one to consider. I mean, if that were to be the scenario that played out, I think you could then look at Ange's tenure, assuming, as Tom says, it doesn't kind of turn really toxic or nuclear, and say he was a really important stepping stone away from the win now managers, the dour football under Conte, Mourinho, Nuno, etc., towards a more progressive approach, a return of kind of the Tottenham that fans want to see, and the start of building a young squad that can play modern football. And if he is a stepping stone in time, then I think great. Obviously, there'll still be most people at the club wanting this to be a kind of long-term thing that works out. But I think that's an important point that Tom's made.
I think it's a really good point. The only thing, as we come onto the January transfer window, and before the end of this pod, we'll also name our player of 2024 and our biggest moment of joy and biggest disappointment. There have been a few of those. But that does make a lot of sense. But what's the policy then with the January transfer window? Is the assumption that whoever takes over from Postecoglou, because this is what Tottenham are trying to do, is just maintain a rhythm. So will it not matter who is signed in January? Whoever comes in to replace Postecoglou, if there is a replacement, will be looking for that type of player anyway? Or are the club thinking, we might be getting rid of Postecoglou, therefore what is the point of giving him millions of pounds to spend in January?
Yeah, I think the former. You said it there. Like, yes, you don't want to be buying a whole load of players for a manager that you don't think has a long-term future. And that is one thing that slightly concerns me about this January. Ange, by the way, called more than once for help in his press conference after the Wolves game, kind of unprompted, which I thought was quite telling. It was almost like his way of sort of putting pressure on the club. You know, obviously much more mild than the way Conte would have done it, for example. But yeah, I think the good thing about Postecoglou is the players he wants should suit any progressive manager. I mean, you mentioned Iraola there. Let's assume that he's a long-term target for the sake of this conversation and the Spurs want him in the summer. If you go out and buy two or three players in January, a centre-half who can play high and is good with the ball and a forward who can press from the front, then you are buying players that Iraola will like, particularly if they're kind of young and malleable. You are not buying 34-year-old specialist wing-backs from the Serie A who are no use to a kind of progressive manager. And that's what Spurs had under Conte. You are buying players that most progressive forward-thinking coaches are going to want because they're young, they're fit, they're technically good, they can press, etc., etc. So I don't think there's a huge risk in Spurs backing Postecoglou in January, even if they're, you know, even if his position is precarious, which it obviously is, and they're kind of concerned about his long-term future. The other option is you do loan deals with an option in the summer. So if a new manager comes in, he has a choice whether to pursue the player or let them go and pursue someone else.
Massive, unnecessary and unprovoked swipe from Dan, defenders in Syria there, in my opinion.
Sorry, you embarrassed it. I did quite like you for a period.
I think also in January, it's, you know, there's little risk of Tottenham spending 60 million on a player in January. You know, that's, even if some people would like that to happen, we're probably thinking, you know, that the deals they were going to try to do are more like squad players who come in, can add something to the depth and the rotations that we've been talking about. But they're not going to be the kind of statement signings that we think are going to sort of transform the starting 11. So in terms of that, of the sort of managerial dynamic, you know, if you get a new manager, I don't think there's that much risk with that, you know, because you're bringing in squad players maybe for low-ish money who a different manager may or may not fancy, but they're not going to sort of deplete them of transfer funds longer term.
Mm. Do you want to have a swipe at Højbjerg while you're up to mischief with former great players of this club, but how we've missed Pierre-Emil Højbjerg over the past season and a half, Kilpatrick?
I would love to have a swipe at Højbjerg if possible. Let's start up a separate pod where I can just rant about him. I mean, no, look, there's a little positive. Archie Gray rendered Højbjerg irrelevant already, which is great.
Okay, well, I think you've both spoken a lot of sense about what might happen in terms of the manager and the January transfer window. Just looking at the games, I think, you know, what's worth noting as well in terms of Tottenham's recent fixtures, Liverpool runaway leaders, we had to play them. Nottingham Forest, actually second in the table, as ridiculous as it sounds. And you face a Wolves side on a bounce, new manager. They won two in a row without conceding. So you could argue that the fixtures have conspired against Ange a little. And next is Newcastle, who are going to play Manchester United between now and when Spurs actually meet them. But they have won, I think, five in a row in all competitions, four in the league. So they're producing their best form of the season. And then Liverpool again, of course, in the League Cup. And it's the League Cup that I just want to ask you both about. I know there was a mixed reaction to the fact that the first leg is at home. I think that's a really good thing, because what I desperately want is for the tie still to be alive come the second leg at Anfield. And if we've gone to Anfield and got beaten 3-4, then doesn't matter what happens second time around. So realistically, and I don't think as well, Dan, by the way, that Liverpool, having spoken to my mate, are going to rest many, if any, of their top players, because Slot, they're in a great position in the Champions League. They're more likely to rest some there, and he wants to get a bit of silverware as quickly as he possibly can. But what realistically can Spurs do? Is it mission impossible over two legs against Liverpool, particularly with a Newcastle game just a few days before that? Or should we still have a degree of hope that a miracle can be achieved?
I think Spurs fans should have a lot of hope. You know, I don't think the turnaround for the Newcastle game is too bad, really. It's Saturday lunchtime to Wednesday night, so that's enough time to recover the legs and you know, have a fresh team for Liverpool. You're right, or your friend is probably right, that they're almost in too strong a position in the league and Champions League. It would be much better for Spurs if Forest or Chelsea or Arsenal or someone was right on their shoulder in the league, and that might prompt Slot to be a bit more cautious in the Carabao Cup. But they're just in such a healthy position in their two main competitions that they probably can afford to go for this. But look, I kind of, yeah, Andrew said this several times, but and I think he's right. You know, Spurs, when everything clicks, and it takes a lot, but when it happens, they are a really impressive team still. And as we've said, the players are still playing for Ange. So I think, you know, a Spurs at home in a one-off game, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but kind of under the lights, you'd imagine the atmosphere would be up for that. It's a semi-final. You know, I think they could do some damage to Liverpool. And, you know, if they forget about the six goals conceded, they can remember that they scored three against them at home quite recently and try and kind of channel that positive attacking energy into a result. I mean, I've no idea at this stage whether Van de Ven has a chance, but I mean, that would obviously be a big plus against presumably Salah and Diaz, who are just in phenomenal nick at the moment. But yeah, I think there's reason to be optimistic. I tend to agree with what Tom said last time in the pod, which is that it's never great playing the second leg at Anfield, that they can do special things in two-legged ties when they are at home in the second leg. It's not what you want. Just ask Barcelona or anyone else. But it's probably quite good for Ange that he's at home in the first leg, because it means if Spurs can nick a win in that game, or even you know, go to Anfield level, then that probably buys him a bit more time to kind of just get players back and navigate his way through January before the second leg.
Interesting to see if they sort of push, in inverted commas, some players back for that match. You know, if they have a decision to make on Van de Ven, for example, you know, would they risk playing him in that game with the possibility that he could pull up again and miss, you know, the majority of the rest of the season? I don't know.
I genuinely think there's almost becoming like a player welfare story if Spurs keep doing that, if Ange keeps doing that. So, it's a good point, but I almost feel like he's got to err on the side of caution now with everyone. But there's so much on that game. There really is. I mean, you could, if you win that game by a couple of goals, you can almost lose to Arsenal, you know, and there still be a degree of, you know, optimism and support, because you think we're not far away from a cup final here. So it's a massive game.
I mean, I guess if you do look at it positively, and Dan makes a good point there, you know, there are some real opportunities here for kind of mood turners for the season. You know, there's three or four games now. You know, who would have thought that Tamworth could be a mood turner? But, you know, there are three or four matches here where the season could just gather some momentum again. You know, imagine if, let's put some imagine if scenarios. If Spurs do beat Liverpool at home 2-0, you know, imagine, you know, just suddenly the whole mood of the club lifts again. Imagine if they go to the Emirates and win, you know, in that match and really kind of put Arsenal almost out of the title race, you know. I don't know what the scenario is for Tamworth. So they go there and win 5-0, you know, and everyone's back and playing brilliantly again. You know, there are three or four opportunities here, if you look at it positively rather than negatively, where Spurs could generate a little bit of uplift again and push themselves through into the second half of the season.
Yeah. Anything could happen. And I've just seen some pigs flying over my house. player of 2024, Danny Boy, for you. I think we're all going to go with the same guy, but you lead the way.
Well, as I get first pick, I think we should all try and pick someone different, or talk about someone different. I'm assuming you want to do Kulusevski, so I'll do Brennan Johnson, because there was an interesting stat from yesterday's game, which was that Johnson has played in every single Spurs game in the calendar year, which I thought was really interesting. And actually, there is a quite compelling case that in the current situation and in Ange's team, availability and durability are almost more valuable traits than talent. You know, if you can be a good player, and I think Johnson could be a very good player, and play every week and be available every week, then you are an enormous asset. And it really surprised me to learn that Johnson hadn't missed a single match of the calendar year. He has been a really important player, whether that's kind of coming off the bench at halftime or early in the second half, in the latter half of last season when he started to pick up some rhythm, or as the kind of quite consistent back post goal scorer that he's been this season, certainly since the Arsenal game and his legendary deleting of social media, which seemed to change everything. I think he's been very good. And he, you know, again, I would say he's just an example of a player that Postecoglou's clearly improved, although you may dispute that. He arrived with a kind of reputation as a promising up-and-coming winger. And I think as we speak today, he is a pretty established Premier League goal scorer, who is limited in certain respects, but you kind of know will pop up at the back post or finish a chance or create one, as he's done so often recently. So I'm going to go for Brennan Johnson. I think there's a room for growth for him, certainly, but he's starting to look like a pretty canny use of 40 million, I think it was, or 50 million. So yeah, I'll plump for him.
His goal scoring record is excellent, no question about that. I still feel he drifts in and out of games, sometimes doesn't work hard enough. Someone said to me yesterday as well that Dominic Solanke has never scored when Johnson has played. And I cannot confirm or deny that stat, but you know, I want to put Solanke in the mix. I think despite the fact that he hasn't scored the weight of goals that is perhaps expected of anybody who's trying to fill Harry Kane's shoes, I think he's a wonderful all-round player. But I am going to go with Kulusevski. Apologies, Tom, if that was your choice. I mean, I remember saying when he appeared to be struggling a little bit in that wide role, and we'd say, oh, he's a little bit predictable. You know exactly what he's going to try and do. There's no real end product, et cetera, et cetera. Has he even got a future at the club? Yet he'd always been saying, my best position is tucked into the middle there. And so I'm glad the club listened to him. He's been absolutely outstanding. He must be exhausted. And yet, even yesterday, he ran and he ran. And the way that he stopped on a sixpence, turned and laid the ball back for Johnson for that second goal was absolutely fantastic. So I think he has to win the award. Tom, can you throw another name into the list of possibles?
I guess a bit difficult for that, I think. I've been sort of scrolling up and down the squad and sort of thinking, I mean, you know, there are a couple of, I think, Saar, for example, I think, if you compare him to where he maybe was a year ago, I think he is now, you know, one of Tottenham's more important players. I think he's kind of grown into that role. We, I suppose, miss him. You know, we know that we've seen when he's not there, they miss him. The balance of the midfield, I don't think, is never the same when he's not in the side. I think, you know, a couple of quiet ones for Archie Gray, you know, I think is, you know, really performed admirably in basically every single position he doesn't play across the back four. And there is a possible scenario, I think, where we kind of look back in 2 or 3 years' time and whether Ange is or is not still at the club, and we think that first kind of educational season for Gray was actually a really important part of his development. I just think he's kind of slotted into every single position in really difficult circumstances and done a pretty good job. I mean, after that, I think it's been a difficult year for Spurs. You know, it's hard to kind of pick out, you know, numerous players who have had brilliant years. But I think Kulusevski is by far and away, you know, Tottenham's player of the calendar year. And I think Johnson is a good shout. You know, we have to say it was, you know, maybe a year ago, I don't know, when we were kind of saying, are we ever going to see kind of the Johnson that Tottenham hoped they'd sign? You're saying drifting in and out of games, Marcus. That is kind of true. But it wasn't so long ago that Johnson was drifting in and out of the team. And he was basically struggling to hold down a spot and was only ever playing well when he came on for sort of fits and starts of 10, 20 minutes here and there. So I think those two are the real obvious ones. And then, you know, two or three youngsters maybe who have made promising starts.
Can I just point out, this is player of the calendar year, and you've mentioned Solanke, Marcus, and Archie Gray, who both signed in the summer. Why you haven't gone for Jed Spence, Marcus, on the back of a wonder run of three games?
Well, what I would say about that, it just shows we didn't do a lot in the first half of 2024, did we? By the way, 12 months from now, I wouldn't be surprised if Jed Spence is part of the equation if he continues as he started. I know you've got to shoot off in a moment, Danny Boy. So final one, highlight of the year. Calendar year, low light of the calendar year. For me, I mean, I guess it's always you kind of remember the things that have happened more recently. I think it's got to be, I know that they've turned out to be a terrible team in the past few weeks, but winning 4-0 at Manchester City, I don't think could be bettered. I mean, it was a great win at Aston Villa by the same margin earlier in the season. The 3-0 at Manchester United was impressive as well. But I was, you know, watching that win, I was having to pinch myself. And I know since then everyone else has beaten City, but we actually started the rot by beating them in the League Cup and then so emphatically at home in the league. I know United have beaten them subsequently on home soil, but that was a bit of a smash and grab. We destroyed them. And for all their travails, apart from United, they haven't lost another game at home. So I think that has to be the highlight for me. And the low light, I just think, unfortunately, it's just the gradual loss of belief. I mean, I just remember we were all so excited November of 2023. Ange made the most fantastic start. And then gradually it's drifted away. Then you're thinking, okay, the start of this season, it's going to be glorious again. And it hasn't been. So for me, it's just that realization that, oh, I think we're in that cycle once more where we're talking about sacking a manager and it's all Daniel Levy's fault and Enid need to go. And we know they're not going to go anywhere. So it's just being back where we've been on so many occasions that I would sort of categorize as my ultimate disappointment of 2024. Tom?
I think with highlights, you know, there actually are quite a few highlights this year in terms of sort of one-off games. You know, you can have your gripes with Ange about the consistency, but actually they have delivered. You know, in moments, Tottenham have delivered. You know, you look at the two hammerings of Aston Villa, for example, going to Old Trafford and winning, you know, very easily. Of course, that City game, you know, it was a statement performance, I guess, is you know, a kind of slight cliche, but it was, you know, and Tottenham, you know, have a lot of, have had a huge hand in the kind of collapse of Man City. They started it, they accelerated it. And I think blowing City away, a kind of Pep Guardiola team in their own ground, you know, maybe it's, I think we said this, I said this at the time, that that must have been a huge moment for Postecoglou, and whether or not he survives at Spurs long term, even just playing like that, you know, in a one-off game, I think would have been a sort of seismic marker in his kind of life and managerial career. And it was an incredible game. There aren't that many games, I think, that you remember seasons for. And I think even non-Spurs fans will remember that game in the kind of handful of matches of this season in years to come. So that was an amazing night. I personally took a great deal of pleasure in Ange also singling out Dan in a press conference when he said he'd read his article, and he said it was a very good article, mate. And it was an article kind of basically justifying Ange's survival as coach for the medium term. So maybe not entirely surprising, but was also a great deal of pride for our. Tottenham Way colleague.
So that's why you've got a soft spot for him. You like one of your articles. I mean, it doesn't take much, does it?
Yeah. I mean, this was after I'd blown a lot of smoke up his arse. So maybe he's a listener to the pod.
Yeah.
That may be
it. In which case, he's listening with great anticipation for your player of the year, biggest highlight and biggest low point.
I've done player.
Oh, sorry.
I can't look beyond Man City as a game. I think as a standout moment, Van der Ven's assist at Old Trafford, I think was a great moment to witness. I really enjoyed that one. That kind of springs to mind. Low light. I think the second half against Brighton, I keep coming back to that actually as just a kind of huge moment in the season. I think the run Spurs are on before that was so good. It had been 7 wins in a row, I think, in all competitions. And it had been a shaky start. But then after Arsenal, it felt like things had really stabilised. And that just, that felt like a kind of derailing moment. I think there were a couple more wins after that, albeit one in Europe. Maybe it was against Alkmaar.
West Ham, yeah.
West Ham, Alkmaar, West Ham. But it just felt like it shook confidence and kind of derailed things. And, you know, we had Ange kind of lashing out at the players' mentalities, and suddenly it felt a little bit Conte-ish and a little bit Mourinho-ish again. And so I think that was just a bad day at the office. And I kind of wonder, you know, what repercussions that second half has had. You know, had Spurs got that third goal before half-time, and I remember Brendan Johnson having a big chance, you know, might we be just in a better position today?
One other positive one was Mikey Moore, I think. You know, and I think it was in that AZ Alkmaar game, you know, where he played so well on that left wing, and Madison said he felt like we had Neymar, you know, on that flank. You know, that was a nice night, that, you know. I think there was a huge expectation around Mikey Moore. Kind of all the fans wanted him to play, they wanted to see him play, and for him to play as well as he did that night, and it's been a shame since that obviously he hasn't quite been able to kind of keep momentum going for reasons of illness. But hopefully, you know, I think it's possible that Moore could have a big year in 2025. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all hoping for a lot more in 2025. Danny Boy, anything else you want to say before you dash off for some important assignment?
I've got a
lunch with Potter. Lunch with Ange? Is it?
It's not. I'll leave. I'm gonna sign off after this, but I'll leave you on an interesting note, Marcus. I know something you've been drooling over for some time is the possibility of Spurs signing Jack Grealish. Well, Jack Gorn from the Daily Mail said Spurs are monitoring his situation going into January. There you go.
Oh, we're always monitoring everybody's situation. Nothing ever comes of it, but okay. Oh, I'm excited now. Thank you, Danny Boy. You scurry off your lunch. That's Dan Kilpatrick of The Standard. Thanks to Tom Allnut. If this was visible to everybody, you'd have seen that he's been eating his lunch during the course of this podcast. I hope it was tasty.
I tried to do it on silent with the mic off, you know, when I was slurping soup and things, but yeah.
Yeah, well, no, it looked lovely. So thanks to Tom from The Times. I am Marcus Buckland. That is it for 2024. Listen, I know it's tough. I've been a Spurs fan for long enough, but keep believing, guys. Anything might happen over the course of the next 12 calendar months. Whatever does, we will bring it to you. In the meantime, come on, you Spurs.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.